welcome to a special edition of 100% Canucks, remembering John Garrett. We all got the news on Monday or Tuesday this week, the passing of Cheech, an iconic person in and around the Vancouver Canuck family. For Canuck fans, heck, for NHL fans, and for hockey fans everywhere. I knew John Garrett for more than 40 years, worked alongside him proudly, both at Hockey Night in Canada and at Sportsnet. He was the consummate professional. He had no ego. He believed in a team, and he made you feel special. And you could see that every night that he worked with John Shorthouse and Dan Murphy, certainly on the Sportsnet regional packages for the Canucks. Today, a special discussion about John and what he is and what he did for so many people, with two of the broadcasters that he worked alongside with for so many years. Jim Hewson, the former voice of Hockey Night in Canada, the former voice of the Canucks, and the lead play-by-play man for Hockey Night in Canada now, Chris Cuthbert, who both did a lot of work with John through the years. So it'll be Landon and me, Cuthbert and Hewson, remembering John Garrett on this edition of 100% Canucks.
I won't keep you long. Darren Millard with a tip for everyone who loves great hockey podcasts like this one. John Shannon and I host the OG of 100% Hockey, coming your way multiple times a week. The guest list is the best you will find. Multiple shows a week ensures you won't miss out on any news, and we dig even deeper into the biggest stories around the NHL. Most of our guests are also friends, so I promise there'll be more conversation beyond the X's and the O's. John really does get bored with that after a while. So join us for 100% Hockey. The name says it all. Subscribe now while you enjoy thinking about it. And enjoy.
The life and times of John Garrett, joined by Landon, obviously, and Jim Hewson and Chris Cuthbert. The latter two gentlemen obviously spent a lot of time in the broadcast booth with John over the years. I would assume, Chris, I think you were probably first before Jim. Would that be correct?
I think I probably was first as a host with Don Whitman alongside, and then Cheech and I kind of started games late 80s, early 90s. Jim's probably more a lot more recent because, you know, what's amazing for me, I still feel like I was so close to him. We hadn't worked together really for 30 years, but he always stayed in touch. He always a few weeks ago when I reached out because we were in Buffalo, we were close to the Anchor Bar, and Jim, you wouldn't be surprised that we put in a lot of miles and chicken wings at the Anchor Bar, and you walked into that establishment, and who else would you think of but John Garrett. So, yeah, that was probably the last time I talked to him, and it was a sad time, too, because his brother had just passed away, and he was preparing the eulogy, and it was tough. I could tell that for the first time in probably forever, when I had talked to John, it wasn't Cheech. We were on a different level with that conversation, and probably the last thing he said to me via text was that he hoped to continue next year as long as he was healthy, and that those words just kept coming back to me in the last 48 hours. He loved what he did. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to keep doing it.
So, Jim, your connection would have been too in the time as you started out when he was playing for the team, correct?
Yes, when you think about it, many of the early years when I was broadcasting on radio, I would fill in for Jim Robson. I would do radio when he was doing television, and John was still playing in some of the first games that I did. Then it was, you know, then there was a long period of time where he was off doing things. And it's funny that Chris mentions, I think Chris might have been the first play-by-play guy he worked with. But anybody who knows Cheech knew that he had a numerical list of the number of play-by-play commentators he had worked with. And he would never stop reminding any of us where we were. Like, I think I was 32 or something like that. It was just another number.
I wasn't top five either, Jim. I was six, apparently.
But. Just another number along the way. And I don't know whether it was ever really accurate or not, but Cheech always loved to let everybody know. And as soon as somebody else came along, whether it was Hunter Ryan, whether it was whoever, you're number 46 of the play-by-play men I've worked with. And here, have a fisherman's friend.
Yes.
I always thought that I hope there wasn't a health problem with eating too many fisherman's friends, the throat lozenges that come in the little tin can, because every time we sat down to broadcast a game, he'd flip it open and you couldn't help but, it's like kids with candy on the table. You can't help but just help yourself. And the next thing you know, the can had be gone. And I'm thinking, I'm not sure that they were designed to eat 100 of these a night.
And they clear the sinuses. I forgot about the tin can, because I don't know if you can get them in the tin cans anymore, but he was the king of the fisherman friends.
But he kept the tin cans, and so after you couldn't get the tin cans anymore, he'd buy the little bags, and then he'd rip them open and pour them into the tin cans. That's so that great. We always had fisherman friends as part of our broadcasts. But it was funny how he was quirky in some ways about some of the things that he did. And one of them was his computer, which he didn't really have.
Right.
Because as you may recall, Chris, he would sit down beside me on the airplane all the time. And I flip open a computer and do something or other, or I wouldn't at all, or watch a game. And he would reach into his briefcase and pull out his manila envelope with his, a list of every team and every player on every team. And then he would open up the newspaper to the summaries from the night before, so he could go through and add the goals and assists and check everything off on what was ostensibly his computer to keep track
and
of everything.
It was special graph paper he used. And he always said, if you're going to do this, you got to use this paper. Now, I was pre-internet with him. So it's amazing for me to hear you say, you know, 30 years later or 20 years later, you're still doing the same thing.
The wonderful thing about that, and I think that we can all appreciate, is that when you write things down, it's comprehension and retention. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason he did it. And I find that I was always making notes of things too. And while I watched games, I would make notes. And it was not because I really needed to make them, but it was because if I write things down, I might actually remember it at a later time. And I think that's why John got in the habit of that. And then once he realized that guys would chide him about it every once in a while about his, you know, paper computer that he had, then he wanted to do it and make sure that everybody saw it, because he liked the fact that he was the only guy doing it.
Like, you know, obviously I never worked with him. It's my second year in media, but I'm in Vancouver. So, you know, of course I've heard stories, and, you know, my dad was pretty close, or is close, with Murph and Shorty and them. And so since the time I've been 10, which was the year I moved here, and it was the year he started with Sportsnet with the Canucks, you know, I've heard so many stories of just, you know, one of always him being incredibly happy and loving his job. But I mean, you just said it with the fisherman friend, but just so many different things from the road and around the rink of him just in such a sport that people take the job so serious. He found the fun in all of it. And it's so fun for me hearing these stories. But even over the last 2 years being up in the gondola, the amount of times that something silly or dumb will happen, and out of that comes at least one Cheech story.
Yeah.
It's the coolest part for me, right? That didn't get to know him, but man, like, just like every other fan, they feel like they know him, that laugh, right?
Yeah, he. I mentioned this last night, being in Montreal, and whenever we did games in Montreal or Quebec, and we did the great Montreal Quebec series in '93, he was hugely popular in Quebec, even though he wasn't there very long. He was a character, and the French media liked him. All the people around the Quebec Nordiques liked him, and surprisingly enough, everybody connected with the Montreal Canadiens liked him, and there wasn't a lot of mutual like back then between the two franchises. And he was Jean Garat, and he'd have some broken French in there to entertain. And he cut a wide swath of popularity across so many levels, from hotel workers to airport people to Gordie Howe and to, everybody in the business.
He bridged a huge gap, a huge period of time. You think about, people suggest someone spent a lifetime in the game. Mm-hmm. Well, he did.
Yep.
And especially at the NHL level, I mean, as a player, then an almost general manager or assistant general manager. Yeah. And then his time in the broadcast industry. And I think, Landon, to your point, one of the keys to his success and popularity was the fact that John didn't take himself very seriously. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean I never like to say that about somebody and think that being disparaging in the sense that they didn't take their job seriously. It was anything but. He knew exactly how to prepare. He knew when the game was serious. He knew when it required a degree of insight and seriousness in the broadcast or whatever. But he didn't take himself too seriously. I think he always remembered that we worked in the toy department. And yeah. I think that's part of the incredible popularity he had with fans and with people within the game, because every rink we went to, all of the people were always coming over. The morning skate was an awesome time for John to visit with a whole bunch of people who really liked him.
What was he like to work with in the booth, Chris?
I just wanted to add, because it's partly about how he was in the booth too, but he didn't take himself that seriously, but he made sure nobody else took themselves too seriously. If he thought somebody was getting a little high on themselves or self-important, man, he had a way of bringing that right back down to the right level. But I think his strength was, in the booth. I wanted to say this last night because he was so. Dick Irvin loved working with him and called us the happy gang when we were a three-man booth. And that was, John, you can correct me, but I don't know how many three-man booths there were back then when it started. And it was seamless because of him. He had so much respect for Dick, as we all do, but his reverence for Dick was... it worked out so well when we were on the air, because he always brought Dick into it. He'd do his analysis as well as anybody else, but he knew that Dick had something else important to bring to the broadcast. And I think Jim's the same way. I think we do our best to make the analyst comfortable, and the analyst in our way try to give them the runway to shine. And John was doing that with Dick as well. And I just found that he had this great sense of how it was supposed to work, and he made it work very well.
He never thought he was a star though, did he? Right?
Oh, Jimmy? No. And if that exactly, he didn't think he was John Garat, backup goalie or whatever, who was living the time of his life. And again, he wasn't going to let anybody else think they were stars either. Although I think if anybody might have been the exception to the rule, it might have been Dick, just because of his great respect for him.
But you said it there, right? Like in their backup goalie, and there's, on top of having to be able to do the job and jump in and play the games and get wins, one of the other like unofficial most important jobs or parts of that job is being like the best teammate. Yep. And, you know, from the last few days, that's all you hear, too, is he was the best teammate, whether it was an old player teammate or colleague in the media. It's the same thing.
Yeah, you never thought, Landon, about hitting the road with John in our industry, about him as a teammate. You never thought twice about what was going to happen when the plane landed and the bus got to the hotel. Nobody went out without checking with Cheech to make sure that we knew where we were going, and we knew, you know, it would be a place without utensils, but it would be a place where you could watch a game and just enjoy everybody around. Now, to suggest that we would go to those places and, you know, we had to be glued to the game, we had to, you know, watch every second of it, not a chance.
No,
you know, We'd have an idea. It'd have to go back and look at the summary later that night to figure out what happened in the game. But it was all about his social experience.
Yeah.
And the one thing that I would say about John, and I know from sitting beside him on the plane and the bus, we could dissect anybody's power play. We could talk about the Hartford Whalers or the Minnesota Fighting Sea and all those stories. And he had such a self-deprecating sense of humor about the great stories he loved to tell. But where he really lit up and where the conversation really got interesting is if we talked about family.
Yeah.
And he absolutely loved it. He was always updating on what Sharon was up to, what Sarah and Krista were up to, and later what grandkids were up to. It was the love of his life, and that's where the conversation always went back to. We never sat beside each other or you know, those groups where we went out for dinner. It was about a whole lot of family and some hockey on the side.
Yep. Hey, Jim, can I ask a question? Because I was tracking the late stages of his career. I went through the whole Hockey DB, and we could talk about every buddy that he's played with because it's a stunning list. But my first encounter with John Garrett, as it turned out, was, and Jim would remember, we used to do our interviews on the boards. And maybe Jim didn't do it because I was, I guess, doing CBC Edmonton television. So we'd have to have a report for the game. And we would be on the boards during practice and we'd call players over. And you can imagine, not normally would you call a goalie over. And I remember the first time I saw him skate around, he's yucking it up, and he's clearly the center of attention on the ice. And so I called him over, and I thought, man, what an incredible personality. No wonder he's Cheech, and he's going to be in the business. And the reason I bring it up is, for two reasons. The previous time he'd been in Edmonton, he had been beaten 12-1. He was in for all 12. 36 saves, 48 shots. And here he was skating around like he was going to a party. And that night, John Garrett beat the high-flying Edmonton Oilers in 1985, 3-1. And the other reason I bring it up, and I'm going to ask Jim about this, is that was the second last game he ever played. He went into Calgary a couple of days later, and that's the last time he played. And I don't know if I ever got the story of why it was over then, because he certainly went out on a bit of a high, I think.
Yeah, I wish I could answer that question. I don't know.
And that's in December or January, I think. So he might have been hurt. I don't know.
I don't remember that he got hurt. I remember the game you're talking about because he used to mention that game. But no, I don't know why or how it eventually came to an end at that particular time. But I mean, clearly, when you listen to his stories, he knew that there was a chance that this was, you know, he knew at the time that what was going on in his career. And he always told all these stories about the things that he did as a backup. That's why the great famous story about having a hot dog in his glove in Quebec City was there, because he milked it for all it was worth in terms of he could be really good, But he was also knew where his place at that point in the game was.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing is that he loved talking about that Memorial Cup when he joined junior Canadians.
Those are the days when you picked up a player, right?
Right. The junior Canadians played in the OHA. When Montreal beat Peterborough, then they took John as their goalie.
and I guess I don't was it the
he
year
was
before
6-0. He went 6-0 in the Memorial Cup.
Yeah, the year before, I think he staged a major upset of the Ottawa 67s with Dennis Potvin. He was a great junior goalie. And as you said, played for the junior Canadians with Gilbert Perreault and Richard Martin and Jocelyn Gouvernement and many others. But yeah, he didn't mind talking about the Memorial Cup for sure.
So I got to tell you one story about the 19 and whether Chris remembers this or not, because Chris was directly involved. We're doing the World Cup of Hockey in 1996 in Ottawa. And the Finns are playing. Okay, you can't. Don't interrupt me.
I won't. No, it's funny. I forgot this one.
The Finns are playing, and it's a really good guy. I think it's Finland, Sweden, or Finland, United States, and Chris is doing the play by play. And Jari Kurri up the ice. He passes the puck over to Timu Selänne. And I turn and look, and I said, hey, Chris just called him Selänne. Whistle
Let
blows.
Me, can Here's I back a- up for him?
Sure.
Let me back up for one second.
I told
John,
you not to interrupt, but go ahead.
I want to set it up, though. I got to put it in context. I had gone to Finland for European figure skating. And to kind of make it work for CBC, they said, we want you to do a piece on Timo Selänne. So I went to Selänne's house with his father. We did a streeter. And in the streeter, every time I said, what are your thoughts on Timo Selänne, they would say, oh, it's Timo Selänne. So I was kidding around during the warm-up about Selänne because we were not going to switch them. But anyway, I've interrupted. So, now I'll give you the
floor back. See, I told you, I knew he'd interrupt. See, so the play-by-play is going on, and Chris says Selänne, whistle blows. We got a replay of number 8 for Finland, and John Garrett says, "Well, there's Selänne," and I'm going. I'm in the truck saying, "Now two guys are saying Selänne," and we go to commercial, and I said, "Boys, what's going on here? It's Selänne," and Cheech said, "God bless him." He said, I said Selänne. I didn't want to make Chris look bad.
Yep. Yeah. He was going to follow the lead. That's the team guy, and that's why it's a great story. Got it. I forgot about that, but yeah.
Oh, no. I think we laughed for the rest of the night. It was hilarious. That's what it was.
Come on, John. You didn't laugh at first.
No, John was not laughing.
No, not at first. But you know what? Cheech even had the ability to make the grouchy old guys be happy too, right?
Yeah, constantly. You know, the other thing that he was extremely proud of that people might not know about is this is because it's a period of time that I worked with him. He was extremely proud to finish his university degree in English from Queen's University, mm-hmm. and. I would say he did it online, except he never did it online. He did it by correspondence. Because he didn't use a computer, and nobody seemed to have a laptop at that time. But we'd get on the airplanes, or he'd go to his room, and he was writing exams, and he was sending in essays and things like that. And this is sort of the middle of his broadcasting career, which is after his playing career, which is after a lot of things. And as he was becoming a middle-aged guy, he wanted to have a degree.
Yeah.
And it made absolutely no difference in what he would be doing in his work life, but he wanted that degree, and he got it, and he was very proud of it.
His dad was a principal, I guess, and so he was. And another aspect, and Landon, I'll bring you in, because we get a lot of propaganda about that Trail BC Little League team that your dad played on, and
Yeah, Cheech was very proud that I think he was on an Ontario championship. And I've been trying to think of the exact name of the team because it was either the Trenton Battawa Braves or the Battawa Trenton Braves or something like that. I've been looking it up, but he every time baseball season started, he'd remind us that he was he had played on a championship baseball team and back in Trenton. So yeah, there's a little bit of a comparable to the old man.
I was about to say, it's amazing. Anyone that was a good ball player when they were younger will find any way to work it into a conversation. And the smile, like all this, the things that these guys have accomplished in their actual sport.
Yes.
And that's the thing that puts the biggest smile on their face. It's funny, ridiculous and perfect.
Yeah.
A couple of notes. I've been talking to a few people the last couple of days, and you mentioned the food, Jimmy. I talked to somebody who was in charge of part of the travel for the Canucks in those years, and particularly the later years when it was John Shorthouse, Dan Murphy, and John traveling on the charter. And of course, teams were much more compelled to have nutritious meals on the planes than they were in the old days. And there was fruit and there was grilled chicken and there was salads, and except there was one meal every time, burger and fries for John Garrett. Because all he asked for, the burger I think was a bonus, because he says, all I want is French fries. That's all I need. I just need some French fries. So I ended up talking to Mark Crawford earlier this week about John, and their paths crossed a few times as players, as coach, broadcaster. But he said Mark called him his idol. He said when I was around there and he was in Trenton, he was my idol because he played on a junior hockey team, a championship team. George Ferguson, Bob Daly, and those guys all played together, and you know, he was a great athlete, and never really flaunted that either. And the other guy I got to bring up, Jimmy, because you got close to him, and Chris, I know you knew him well too, but John's relationship with Roger Nielsen, who's over your right shoulder, Jim.
Yeah. No, he was. It's when you mention all of this sort of stuff, it all comes back to me too about the conversations we would constantly have. And you could bring up just about anybody in the world of hockey in a conversation, and John had crossed paths with him somewhere. I mean, the man played with Gordie Howe. He played with Dave Keon. He played, you know, he knew Raj. He had played for and played goal for Raj at different levels. So
worked at the school too, I'm sure, right?
Yeah. Yeah. But when he told those stories, they were always believable. But it was, you go back to talk about the Minnesota Fighting Saints or the Birmingham Bulls or some of the nonsense that went on in the WHA when they, you know, day to day, they weren't sure if they were getting a paycheck or not. And he was, you know, had no idea who owned the team on some days and that sort of thing. Every story he told would be a connection to another group of players or another player. And I would always be in amazement that what a rich history. You name a player that played between the years that he started and finished his career, and he crossed paths with him at some point, whether it was joking with him in the middle of a fight when the Bulls were taking on everybody, or whether it was a hockey school or an awards ceremony, whatever it was. He just he knew everybody, and he was very fond of Raj, as many of us were. And the one thing about that too is they were both. They both had a great self-deprecating sense of humor. So there would always be a few laughs when those guys were together, and neither of them took each other or themselves very seriously.
There was another guy we both worked with, Jim, who revered Raj as well. That's Greg Millen. And it's heartbreaking to know that we lost two just tremendous guys within about 53, 54 weeks of each other. And as soon as you mentioned Roger Nielsen, Millsy comes to mind because he loved Raj just as much. It was and obviously the guy over your shoulder was extremely influential for a lot of people.
The famous assist on, as Danny would call him, Father Howe. Father Howe's last goal. Apparently it has happened, but nobody can actually find it officially, Chris. Is that right?
Well, I confirmed, or Ron McLean had done some due diligence to make sure that the assist was credited. And I think they announced that it was last year at some time. So I just, again, reflecting, I was doing the full deep dive on the Hockey DB, and I thought, I'm going to look up the box score and see if the NHL's put it there. And it still wasn't there. It was Gordy from Mark. And so I went to the Hockey Reference, which is my site to go to check out the summary of the game there. Now, they may have added it to John's personal stats. It certainly has been broadcast as if they finally acknowledged they made a mistake. It might have been the worst goal of Gordy's career, a backhand from about 40 feet that I have no idea how it went in. But John Garrett deserved credit for helping set up Gordy's final goal.
Indeed. So, guys, this has been fantastic to sit and talk about what a great man he was. Jim, just before you, what do you think he meant to Canuck fans?
You know, I think he was every man to the Canuck fans, because he could say things that everybody was thinking while they were watching the game at home, but he could say them in a fashion that wasn't necessarily disparaging to those people who made the play. And he had a language all of his own that people got to know. Like everybody out here, you can find a Vancouver fan who can do a John Garrett imitation. And what it usually means is it's using the hat trick on the phrase, which is patience, 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 waits, waits, waits. And he kind of loved that because it was unique to him. And everybody knew that it was coming when he would analyze something. But again, so especially when he got to work with John and Murph, and they became so tight and such good friends. And face it, often in the years that they were together, the broadcast was better than the game. Mm-hmm. The team, they had a better team than the Canucks on a lot of those nights. Sure. And I think that's part of the reason that he understood that. He understood that there's a cyclical nature to the game, and sometimes the team will be good and sometimes it won't. And he never really lambasted them for some of the things he could have. But he also didn't try and suggest something that was there that wasn't. And I think that's why people got to know and love him. And then his relationship on the air with Shorty and Murph became of legend. You know, everybody started to know that he loved ketchup so much. And he reveled in that. I've been to dinner over the years with John many times when he actually used utensils, but he actually loved the idea that people thought that way of him, and he played it up. He tried to be a caricature of himself.
Yes, yeah, yes, 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 yes,
yes.
Yes,
yes, yes.
And there was always, and he was, you know, none of us, I mean, I can't speak for you guys, but I'm certainly not a religious person, but John always gave something up for Lent.
Sorry to laugh about that, but it became a big conversation every year because he was always looking for input about what he should give up this year.
Right. Yeah.
He did give up ketchup one year.
I find that hard to believe.
Yeah. We need an audit on that one.
What were some of the best ones? Give me like the top three that you can remember.
Ketchup seemed to be. Somebody told me he actually the cutlery was one year, but I don't remember if he used the cutlery a lot anyway.
he did give up beer one year.
Oh, okay. Really?
And gave up Coors Light for Lent. And I can tell you it was an unmitigated disaster. I won't tell you why, but it didn't work very well.
did he give up beer? Or did he give up Coors Light?
That's a good question. Just on that, somebody told me this, that he would get a bag on the charter and with six Coors Light
on a long charter, he would get a bag of six, and somebody was sitting beside him once, and often they would give him another bag to go when he left. And somebody I know was on the trip, had hitched a ride on the Canuck charter, and they gave him the bag, and he felt the bag, and he thought, oh, that's not six, that's only five. And he opened and he opened it up, and they counted. He could tell it was only five in the bag, not six.
Well, it is I must admit, when I got the news on Monday of his passing, it was numbing. But in talking about him and in mourning the loss of John Garrett, I think I've seen more people smile to be able to tell a story, to be able to have a laugh. And I think that somehow, some way, John Garrett would love that.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how sad I was to learn of his passing. And in the 24 or 48 hours since I found out, I went through a very profoundly sad period of time where it was really hard to deal with. But I'm coming around now when we tell stories like we are today about what a personality, what a guy, what a friend, what a great coworker.
Well said. I went through the same, you know. At our age, we don't cry very often, but there's been some tears. The one last thing is just how the nickname Cheech is so perfect for the personality, yeah. The character, and I did share this online that just hearing the name Cheech always put a smile on my face, and it will start to again soon. So,
well, thank you, boys, and to Sharon and to Krista and Sarah. We certainly feel your pain, but just know that we loved your husband. We loved your father as certainly in such a manner that he became part of our families as well.
And your grandfather, who he just loved his grandchildren, and they were special too. So our condolences to all. It's fond memories though.
Chris, thank you. Jim, thank you. Thank you very much.
Great chatting with all you guys. You're Thanks. Welcome.
Thanks.
Landon and I will be back after this on 100% Canucks.
NHL TV is now on DAZN. Hockey lives here.
Here we go.
Watch every game from every team. The best players in the world. And the coldest plays on ice. Watch up to four games at once for the ultimate NHL experience. Sign up now at DAZN.
Great to hear from Jim and Chris, guys who worked so many broadcasts with John in the booth, whether it be in Vancouver or in any of the arenas around the National Hockey League. Landon, you said you moved back to Vancouver when John was starting his career as the regional broadcaster. So you've had your fill of Garrett.
Yeah, like, you know, just like a lot of young Canuck fans, like Shorty, John Garrett, and Murph were some of the voices I heard the most on TV because that's what I was watching. I moved here in 02. So I was just turning 10. It was the first time I got to have a TV in my room, and it was in a like little kind of built-in shelf to the right of my bed, and the door was at the far end of the room. So I figured out as a 10-year-old that I could put my blanket up so I could make like my own separate wall so I could have that TV on, and when the light wouldn't go under. So all the games, you know, I'd be in, have to go to bed. It's 9 o'clock, but games are still going sometimes. And, you know, like listening to John describe plays and laugh and have fun. Like I was a kid that loved hockey and he made it fun. Like it was, and, you know, I listened to him in Vancouver till I was 16 and moved to Red Deer. And then it's obviously just catching games whenever he was doing them. But for 6 years, that's who I watched. That's who I listened to. And like I said, my dad is obviously pretty close with Shorty and Murph, and obviously knew John really well. Like the amount of times that my dad would come home from the rink or something and I'd hear a story about John, because again, between all of them, like they had such a dry sense of humor and loved to laugh and kind of make fun of each other. Like the stories that would come back all the time, it was so much fun, you know, like seeing the guy talking about the Canucks on TV, getting to hear these stories. It was, you know, he was someone that was always in the middle of that. If it was a good time happening and a smile happening around the Canucks, especially in those hard years, he was in the middle of that.
Do you recall when you met him, when you had become a broadcaster? Is there something that brings it out? What did he give you? Any advice? Any thoughts?
No. So I saw him one time in the 2 years. Mm-hmm. And you know, I said a very quick hello. But past that, I mean, we just heard, right? Like morning skate was his time to talk to everyone. And, you know, I wasn't going to grab his hand and hold him there for a long time, but like they were talking about, like being on the outside, looking in and seeing him interact with everyone and like almost seeing the queue of people lining up to have their couple minutes with him. Like it's what I would imagine all of us strive to be, right? Have a job that we love and take serious, but we have fun and don't take it too serious, right? Like for a lot of us, it's one or the other. And he somehow found a way in his personality to marry those two and enjoy life.
There's no question he had his priorities on straight when it came to the business, which can be a fickle business, a selfish business. But you would never use that word in describing anything about John Garrett and being a broadcaster. He was never selfish. He was always giving. He always lived in the shadow in my time at Hockey Night in Canada of Harry Neal. But he also knew that Harry was good at his job, and there was going to be lots of time for John to do his as well. You know, the famous Stéphane Matteau goal in New York in Game 7, Devils-Rangers, that put the Rangers to the Stanley Cup Final. John was in the broadcast booth for Hockey Night in Canada. And John did a lot of big games for Hockey Night in Canada and did them so well and did them in a way, and Jim and Chris did reference this, did them in a way that he could still be critical without being negative. And, you know, it's the classic case of the velvet hammer. And so he would find a way to be observant of a play without embarrassing anyone. And he was very good at it. And he also did it. And what I loved about him was that he did it in a manner that the regular Joe could understand what he was saying. He didn't get overly technical, which I hate. And which, you know, is leaking into our game, but John Garrett didn't make it part of his vocabulary. He still talked about forwards and talked about defensemen, and there wasn't a lot of jingoism in his world as a broadcaster. And I think that actually endeared himself to a lot more people in the game. And when you consider that, he passed away the day of a game he was supposed to do in Salt Lake City. I think it told you how much respect he had in the industry that he could still be working at 74 and could still contribute. I actually watched game 2 of the Vegas-Utah series and thought John Garrett was as good as he has ever been, because he was able to go and he did game 1. Spent the day off day with practices with both teams, interacted with everybody, morning skate, interacted with everybody. So he was full of information. And he found a way to use that information in a simple, proper way. He was tremendous, tremendous that night.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like that series to me has been my favorite. And hearing him on those first few games,
yeah,
like it's nostalgic as well, right? Not to say that he didn't do a good job, and it's one of those where you're like, oh, it's just cool because it was him, but you know, I'm chasing my 2-year-old around a little bit. There's dinner being made. I got the game on. I'm trying to do it all. But like that laugh would come through and yeah, you kind of snap your head back. Like it's all that. But you know, for the majority of what you just said, right? Like it's all ego, right? And he didn't have it. And for overcomplicating thing, like that's guys trying to prove that they're smarter and they know the game. And they can tell you how, basically almost just trying to confuse you to prove that they know it. To John, he didn't have to because he had everything else. He had the personality. He had a way of, like you said, not to just reiterate it, but a way of getting the information out quickly and easy to where it just sounds like we're having a quick conversation. Like, oh, hey, did you see that play? That was really cool. He did this and that. Done. It didn't feel like you were being talked down to like it does a lot of times in sport and when people are analyzing it.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's funny too, and we'll finish with this. So when the NHL put out their statement on Tuesday morning about John's passing, and the commissioner talked about having run into John in Salt Lake City, actually, the day of Game 3, the Utah Mammoths' first playoff home victory. Really, as much as it was honoring John, it really was an acknowledgement to his family that we all understand the sacrifices that families have to make for people to do their jobs in the hockey industry. John loved doing what he did. The people who suffered the most when he went away were Sharon and his two daughters and then the extended families. Those are the people that should know now how much John meant to everyone in the game, at the team level, at the league level, at the network level, and at the fan level. John Garrett was a true hockey person. And more importantly, he was the best of us. Thanks for this, Landon.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you for listening and watching. A difficult show to do, but one that had to be done, remembering John Garrett on this edition of 100% Canucks.